Is there a way you can use the antenna tuner, set the controls just right, so that you're going straight into that dummy load without going through any of the tuning network of the tuner? Can you bypass all of the tuner and just go straight to its dummy load? If you can, and you put that on the far end of the cable, and if you have faith in that dummy load, and you repeat the test, that's going to give you a strong indication of what's going on with your antenna analyzer. Right now, your antenna analyzer is sounding a bit suspicious, unless there happens to be some pinches in that BNC cable, the RG58 cable. If the RG58 cable has some failure modes in it where it's been crushed in certain positions, that could be real data, but I'm doubtful. Right now, what you're telling us sounds like a not-so-accurate antenna analyzer. So, once again, can you get directly to that dummy load without any of the tuning controls of that antenna tuner? Over to you, Rich, K2LIW.
Two Bravo Zulu. Yes, I could set it up where it just turn the knob to where it says dummy load coming in and coming out into the analyzer. So I can try that, but I would rather do as you say, get a real dummy load and test random length wires like that. The other thing I'd like to ask you, and this is a real head scratcher and may also point to an analyzer problem, is when I use only the antenna analyzer and the Kenwood 440s tuner, and I tune that to a below, about a good, I can get it down to 1.5 to 1, for instance, on 40 anyway, not on 80. When I then look at the meter on the MFJ tuner, which is in the circuit, the two needles, you know, that cross over, I don't have to explain any more to you about that. You know, when they cross over, you have the reflected and the output and then the reflected. Those two needles are pointing straight up. They're not touching each other at all. They are pointing straight up when the SWR meter in the Kenwood, SWR 1.5 to 1. What would cause them to point straight up when the Kenwood meter or antenna analyzer is telling me I have a near-perfect ratio?
When they point straight up and you vary the amount of power you're putting into that network, do the two needles straight up stay the same? Over to you.
I'm wary of putting a bunch of power into it. You know, it's a 30-year-old rig that I want to be buried with. So I only go about halfway up in terms of how much power I could put into it, and I have not compared the two with a little bit of power and with a lot of power. And that begs the question, or leads to the question, I just lost it, but maybe you could talk to me about the phase chart and how to read the phase chart on this analyzer.
NY2H.
Go ahead, Lou.
All right, I have Andy CDL on the other line here, and we're hearing a lot of noise on that fella's signal, and I'm transmitting to see if he hears it on my signal, because I'm on the east now. So I don't know if my signal's cleaner. We're trying to figure out where this noise is coming from.
Lou, you've got the exact same noise, but your noise is 20 decibels weaker than Rich's noise. So there is noise on the eastern input. You're putting in a hell of a lot more signal than he is. Back to you, Lou.
Okay. All right, very well, thank you. Carry on. NY2H.
Hey, you've got a number of things here that are not easy to explain, Rich. Two needles straight up and they don't cross each other. By the way, where do the two needles sit before you put anything into it? Where do the two needles sit before you put any signal into it? Back to you, Rich. Bravo Zulu, teacher IW.
Antenna, they usually sit with a reflected reading off the charts and a very low power reader.
Understand. And it sounds to me like you're using that machine below its rated power level where it gives you accurate information. That's a guess on my part when the two needles are straight up and not crossing.
Okay, then, you know, then I don't understand. So then it seems to me that the Kenwood 440 analyzer and tuner, is not working correctly. Does this problem sound like that, Dick?
Yeah, you've got a number of suspicious readings on your antenna analyzer, your antenna tuner, the one that's inside of the rig and the one that's outside of the rig. And in order to resolve all of this, you're going to have to go to something that's really trustworthy, a bird watt meter. If you get a bird watt meter with the right slug and you measure true forward power and true reflected power with the bird, and then either using the mathematics or the chart, you know the real standing wave ratio, and you can find out which of your instruments are lying to you. There is a possibility that each of your instruments, in order to read standing wave ratio, reflected power ratio, all that, there's got to be two working directional couplers in every one of those instruments. There's got to be a forward conducting directional coupler and a reverse indicating directional coupler. And they, in turn, have good diodes that are working correctly. And so there's always a way that a spike or an overpower or whatever, lightning, comes down your antenna and damages one of those diodes. And if one of those two diodes, those two directional couplers are damaged, then you get crazy readings. So the only way you're going to get back to bedrock is to borrow somebody's bird watt meter and in these various situations really measure forward power and reverse power and go to the chart or the equation to find out what the true VISWR is. And then you'll find out what is the error in each of your other instruments. That's my best suggestion, Rich. W2 Bravo Zulu, K2LIW.
The comment.
And then that, here's something else that is quite confounding. I mean, I got a 20/S9 on 40 with this rig a couple of days ago, or 10/, I forget, one of those two, with a real good audio report and, you know, what you want to hear from another ham. So it is working, and it always has worked. What I'm going to do is I'm going to put the rig and the antenna in the car. Oh, well, not this antenna, but on the 10/ reading was through my screwdriver antenna. But here's another problem. I pounded into the ground a 9-foot copper rod, first to the rig and then to the antenna tuner. And in both cases, it did lower the noise level on all bands. And other than that, I can't tell any difference. What I did as an experiment was with the screwdriver antenna and the antenna tuner in the rig, I got down to 1.5 around there to 1 as best I could. I then attached the copper wire coming from the ground stake to the antenna, and I couldn't get it anywhere near in tune. I mean, not close to anything usable. Would you know what caused that, W2DZ?
There was somebody who signed in who said they wanted to make a comment. I'm going to go to him first. Rich, you've just given me a very large number of ambiguities. You talked about a screwdriver antenna. You didn't tell me, is it on a car? Is it in the house? Where is it mounted? What's it using as a counterpoint? You added a copper rod with a piece of wire going to it. I can tell there's a lot of missing information. There's a picture in your head that you're not conveying to us. The person who wanted to make a comment, who was that? Please make your comment right now. Give me your call letters and name, and then make your comment. K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
This is WA2VDH. Name is John. I just wanted to make a comment about the original length and where was noticing nulls. I did a quick calculation. 9.7. I used the 9.73 megahertz that he mentioned, and a velocity factor of about 2/3 for RG58. I think that frequency, 9.73 megahertz with 50 feet of RG58U, it turns out to be 3/4 wavelengths. So if the far end is open, he is reflecting back almost a short circuit there if it's 3/4 wavelengths. That's based on a 2/3 velocity factor. So go ahead.
Is 0.66,
which is very close to 2/3. Yeah, that's good information, John. So that calculates to be 3/4 wavelength, and there's also a 1/4 wavelength frequency where if you went down that low, you would probably see another dip. As I see it, let me think now. Now, the amount of signal reflected from the cable, if the cable was in good shape, no matter what signal you send down the cable, at the open circuit end, the amount that gets to the open circuit end, every bit of it has to be reflected if it's an open circuit. Therefore, the real calculated standing wave ratio should be nearly constant but slowly decreasing as you go up in frequency. The fact that there's dips strongly indicates that there's some error in the directional couplers that are indicating standing wave ratio of either the antenna analyzer or the Viswire measurement of the antenna tuner. So until we get a real measurement on something that we trust, a bird watt meter, and you measure forward and reverse power at these various frequencies, until we get that, we won't really know what's going on. You got a whole bunch of mysterious readings. And if the bird watt meter did show that the percentage of reflected power has dipped, then it would say that what you're reading is telling you the truth. Very unlikely. You'd have to have a bunch of dented sections along the RG58 cable in order for the cable to really do that. So I think the next test is a bird watt meter. Beg, borrow, steal a bird watt meter and make a series of measurements. That's traceable to the Bureau. Right now, we believe maybe one of your diodes has been damaged. Quite often a person will read crazy readings of apparent standing wave ratio on instruments if one...
Repeater, timeout.
You'll read crazy readings if one or more of those diodes have been damaged. So right now, that's my best suggestion to you, Rich. W2 Bravo Zulu, K2RIW.
AC2GS.
Go ahead, Roy.
Yes, Dick, thank you. One of the things I think that's come into effect is it really depends on where you put your standing wave ratio meter. You have to put it past the impedance matching circuitry, and I think that's where things are going a little wonky. He has two standing wave ratio measuring devices. One is on his driver, which is correctly placed, which is showing a good match, and the other one is between... his auto tuner on his driver and his additional manual tuner that he's using. And so it's only partially matching. And as far as the Viswa meter on the antenna tuner is concerned, it doesn't realize there's another antenna tuner down the line, and it's just giving the Viswa as if his driver had no built-in internal antenna tuner.
Hey, you brought up a very good point, Roy. I'm also creating the exact same ambiguity. I didn't make it clear. When you do get a hold of the bird watt meter, the bird watt meter will be directly connected to the RG58. What you drive the bird watt meter with is your choice. But the real readings you're going to take is the bird watt meter directly feeding the RG58 cable. And now with the various frequencies, what's the forward and reverse power and the ratio, so to speak. What's the bird watt meter you can trust as long as it, because it's got one single diode detector in there, which is being used in the forward mode and the reverse mode. So you don't have two separate diodes where one could be damaged in the bird watt meter. Assuming you're using a slug that's in good working order. So bird must be connected directly to the cable and then repeat these measurements. And then depending on which instrumentation you're using, working your way back to the rig, which of those readings are now telling the truth and not telling the truth, comparing to the bird, you'll know that's the bedrock, that's the gold standard, if you know what I mean. And you'll know whether or not you should be digging into your antenna tuner, your antenna analyzer, or whatever, to find out which one has a bad diode, if that's what it could have been. Does that make some sense to you, Rich? Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu, K2IW.
A lot of sense, as always, Dick. Anybody want to go into the ham radio equipment rental business? talking about checking things out for a half hour. That's a high price to pay for a bird. Anyway, I understand what you're saying, and what I am going to do, as I said at the beginning, is I'm going to put this equipment, which is just a rig, and the screwdriver antenna, and I could also attach, while I'm doing this, the 50-foot length of coax and see if that configuration is what, you know, this antenna, not the 50-foot length that I got the spikes on, but the screwdriver antenna, that's what it was made for, and I would the world in my car from with that screwdriver and that Kenwood 440 when, you know, propagation was really good. I worked the world. I had a daily drive from the end of the expressway to exit 39 and back every day of the, every day of the working week. So what did I do? I just kept on making contact after contact. So, but that was a long time ago. And we'll see what happens. I'll report back if it's vastly different while this stuff is in the car than in the shack. So I understand everything you said, Dick, and I really appreciate it. Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu. Back to that.
Hey, you've got a significant number of readings that are a little bit crazy. Some one of your friends must own a bird watt meter with slugs for the power level and frequency range that you're talking about. Borrow that bird watt meter. Rent, borrow, whatever. It's the gold standard. It's connected directly to the cable. We'll tell you a truth, and then we'll find out which of your instruments are reading the right amount of forward and reverse power, whether or not they've got a damaged diode in their directional couplers. Each of your other instruments has a pair of directional couplers, one favoring forward and one favoring reverse. That's what's feeding those two needles. And if one of those is damaged or both of them are damaged, you'll get readings that are crazy. The readings you've given us have told us there is an error somewhere in the system, an open-circuited piece of coax cable, RG58, in reasonable shape, should not act that way. So you've got an anomaly, and only the bird is going to resolve it, in my opinion. Okay. We've gone way beyond what we normally do for the first section. We're going to go over to Roy, who's got some interesting subjects to tell us about tonight. AC2GS, Dr. Roy, K2LIW in TechNet. You've got it, Roy.
I got some info for that guy that was asking about the logging program.
Okay. Give us your information about the logging program.
A very popular logging program is Stanley 3 Baca Julia Papa 3SJP. He makes a very popular logging program. That's run by the ARRL. Back to you, Roy.
I'm not sure that I timed the machine out. Did we time out the machine? You guys were listening on 85. I know that that signal came through on 975, 375. Did you guys hear that information coming out of 85?
It came out, but it came out a bit noisy.
Yeah, am I in a better spot now?
You are in a better spot now. So repeat your information just to be double-gone sure.
Okay, the popular logging program is Nancy 3 Fox Juliet Papa N3FJT. It's a very popular logging program. And then, of course, the ARRL Logbook of the World LOTW, which is a free program. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, thank you for that information. Anybody need any fill on that? Are you able to copy it?
WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
The one guy I've spoken to that knows a lot about the logging program would be Ken. You know, he does the computer net, you know, WB2KWC. I think he even gave a talk at one of the meetings or explaining how logging programs work. He sets up all those field day logging systems. You might want to talk to him. And the computer net is always on Wednesdays, but it's the third and fourth Wednesdays of the month. I think he said he wasn't going to be there this next Wednesday. But, 8 o'clock. Just repeat it. Back to you, Dick.
Thank you, Paul. Good information. Roy, AC2GS, with the Science Talk, T2RIW.
Okay, thank you very much, Dick. I was just wondering if Richie N2EO is still out there, because I have some information for his question.
N2EO, are you still there? He may be hearing us in the background. He may come back later. Please proceed, Ray.
Okay, very good. Just as a little bit of a hint, all you have to do is Google these things. There's a whole bunch of different programs. There are programs you can pay for. There are programs that you might have to work a little bit on, but they're free. There's something called MacDrive. There's something called Paragon APFS for Windows. There's another thing called UFS Explorer Standard Access. There's a whole bunch of different options that that Richie can avail himself of. But getting back to the science talk, once again, if you have any topics or questions or any reason to contact me, the email address that's best used is mailbag@ac2gs.com. And I will provide links to all the stories that I talk about tonight. It will be found on the website roy.ac2gs.com. Again, roy.ac2gs.com. So let me drop for a second, and then I'll go on with the story. Well, I can't resist a little story that I recently saw in the news, because it involved amateur radio, and, you know, that's always nice. For several weeks, citizens of North Olmsted, Ohio, a small town a few miles west of a NASA research center, have been plagued by a mysterious force that has blocked their garage door openers and car key fobs from functioning. But after many attempts by amateur sleuths and expert technicians to determine the source of this vexation, the problem had not been resolved. According to the New York Times, North Olmsted officials first began receiving reports about the issue in late April. Since then, more than a dozen residents of the town and neighboring Fairview Park have told authorities about their inability to use garage door openers and key fobs. A local NBC affiliate, WKYC, enlisted a retired engineer to survey the area with a spectrum analyzer to no avail. Spectrum Cable Company, AT&T, and local electric provider First Energy all tried to figure out the source of the issue, according to WKYC. Quote, they began by shutting off the power in places where they detected the strongest readings for interfering radio frequencies, end quote. First Energy spokesperson Chris Eck told the New York Times, but the frequency didn't diminish. Dan DeLisandro, WB8ZQH, a TV repairman, was also among several hams who investigated. He initially picked up these little blips on a signal generator, but finally on one block and at a particular house, the signal was quite loud. Then finally on Saturday, city council person Chris Glassburn alerted the public that they had found the root of the mysterious frequency problem. It was coming from the home of a local inventor. Apparently, he had a fascination with electronics. The man had built a device that notified him if someone approached his property when he was tinkering in his cellar.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Return to normal. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
You timed out, Roy. WS Twin. Tinkering in the cellar right after that. You timed out.
Okay. The way you designed it was persistently to put out 315 megahertz signal. That frequency is many garage door opener and key fobs use. It was also battery operated, so shutting off power in the neighborhood had no effect. The council person would not reveal the man's identity since he had special needs, and there was no malicious intent for the device. The man did not know that his gadget was causing so many headaches in the neighborhood, but a volunteer electrical expert finally pinned it down, knocked on the door, and informed him he was causing the widespread disruption for weeks. The guy removed the battery from his little gadget, and life in North Olmsted returned to normal. Let's try it again. Let's drop for any questions or comments. This is still AC2GS.
BlueB2GXM. Saw that. Fun story.
Yes, Rich, I agree. It's very rare that amateur radios actually get mentioned in New York Times articles, so I felt that I had to give it a little bit more press. But it's a fascinating little story how one guy with a bad idea can screw up a whole bunch of people in a community. On with the next story. We've talked about sundry government agencies planning to simulate an asteroid impact here on Earth. The good news is that Denver survived unscathed. Unfortunately, our lives and property values here on Long Island did not come out quite as good. The asteroid impact added an exciting little wrinkle. If you really want to prepare for an asteroid impact, you might as well simulate some of the worst possible outcomes, like an asteroid blasting into the heart of New York City. Last week, NASA and FEMA and space agencies around the world simulated an impending asteroid strike and how they'd respond during the annual IAA Planetary Defense Conference. But the end of the simulation took a rather unfortunate turn for us here. The simulation began with the imaginary discovery of the fictional 2019 PDC, which had a 1 in 50,000 chance of hitting Earth thanks to its eccentric orbit, that would take it, at closest, 18 times the moon's distance away. But as imaginary years passed in the simulation, the odds of impact steadily increased until it became certain that a 600-foot-wide asteroid would hit the Earth. The location of the impact was initially determined to be near Denver, Colorado, and the researchers determined that the city would face unsurvivable conditions. Even grains of sand would explode. The participants in the simulation decided to slam spaceships into the asteroid in hopes of deflecting it. Let me drop for a sec. But after breathing a sigh of relief, scientists realized that they weren't through the woods quite yet. The final day of the simulation revealed that a 200-foot fragment of the asteroid had broken off and would hit New York City's Central Park in just 10 days. In the simulation, the asteroid would burst a mile above the city, yielding an explosion with as much energy as a nuclear weapon. Much of Manhattan, Brooklyn, Bronx, and Queens, and some of New Jersey and Nassau County would experience unsurvivable pressures from the explosion, although Staten Island would be mostly spared. The city was evacuated as it faced utter obliteration. The scientists writing the simulation could have chosen anywhere in the United States to drop the asteroid, but nowhere was as interesting to them as New York. NBC News reports, in real life, the odds of an asteroid striking just above the center of New York City are rather minuscule, given how large the Earth is and how much of it is water and uninhabited space, and how kind of small New York really is. The simulation captured the many difficult decisions that must go into planning for an impact event, and the potential outcomes of those decisions, and apocalyptic choose-your-own-adventure. In real life, NASA and other space agencies must continue to beef up their asteroid monitoring abilities, since more lead time and better details will let stakeholders make more informed choices. Participants of the simulation issued statements of support for the asteroid detecting infrared telescope to the European Space Agency's HERA mission to measure the results of the NASA DART mission, and for scientists to continue studying the potential hazardous asteroid Apophis, which we spoke about just last week, that's approaching Earth in about 2029. It's a scary universe we live in. The more we know about it, the more we're able to prepare for crises that threaten our existence. Let me drop for any questions or comments.
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
Okay, we'll go on with the next one, I guess. We spoke about the historic images from the Event Horizon Telescope project only a few weeks ago. Their resolution was not the sharpest, as we talked about, even though the scientists used the combined results of 8 Earth-based radio telescopes scattered off the surface of our planet and tweaked the reception for higher than usual gigahertz signals. It was the best image that we could figure out how to get, but science never rests on its old laurels. Now a group of astronomers from Radboud University in the city of Nijmegen, Netherlands, along with the European Space Agency and other partners, are developing a plan to get much sharper pictures of black holes. The group of scientists have a plan for launching radio telescopes into space to get even clearer images of black holes. They've published a paper in the Journal of Astronomy and Astrophysics detailing these plans. Their end goal, to test Einstein's general theory of relativity once again. The Event Horizon Telescope Project is a group of radio telescopes around the world operating in conjunction with each other. They work on the principle of interferometry. Together, the radio telescopes act like a kind of virtual telescope the size of the Earth. That's how we get the telescope large enough to see a black hole. But the Event Horizon Telescope Project is hampered by the same thing as other terrestrial telescopes, Earth's atmosphere. Earth's atmosphere can create a lot of problems for astronomers. Telescopes have to somehow adapt to the atmosphere to gather images of objects at a great distance. That's why telescopes are built in special locations, ideally in arid environments at high altitudes. Let me drop for a second. The Event Horizon Telescope Project radio telescopes are in high-altitude locations around the globe. They're in the Alps, in the Sierra Nevadas, in Altacama, and in Hawaii. But they're still limited by Earth's atmosphere. And that atmosphere prevents the highest frequency radio waves from reaching the telescopes. There's another limiting factor for the effectiveness of the Event Horizon Telescope Project, the size of our Earth. On Earth, we can only use interferometry to link scopes no further than the width of the Earth, so any virtual telescope is limited by the size of our planet itself. The authors of the paper have a solution to both the atmospheric problems and the Earth size problem. They say, let's just put the radio telescopes in space. They call their project the Event Horizon Imager, and they say that it can produce images of black holes 5 times sharper than the Event Horizon Telescope Project. The idea is to put 2 or 3 satellites in orbit that would act as radio observatories out there. They would be free of both the Event Horizon Telescope Project's limitations. In space, you can make observations at higher radio frequencies because the frequencies from Earth are filtered out of the atmosphere. The distances between the telescopes in space are also larger. This allows us to take a big step forward. We would be able to take images with a resolution more than 5 times what is possible for the Event Horizon Telescope Project. The team created simulated images of black holes that represented what the Event Horizon Imager would be able to see. Let me drop for a sec. Sharper images of a black hole will lead to better information. They could be used to test Einstein's theory of general relativity in greater detail. The fact that satellites are moving round the Earth makes for considerable advantages. With them, you can take near-perfect images to see the real details of black holes. If small deviations from Einstein's theory occur, we should be able to actually see them. further tests of Einstein's theory of general relativity are one of the main goals of the Event Horizon Imager. Einstein's theory of general relativity predicts exactly what size and shape a black hole shadow should have. Alternative theories of gravity predict different sizes and shapes, but the differences with the predictions from general relativity are generally smaller than 10% or so. So, to be able to distinguish between general relativity and other theories of gravity, we need a high-resolution image that can only be obtained from space-based observation. There are other theories of gravity. Even though every time scientists are able to test Einstein's general theory of relativity, the evidence supports that theory. There are still some nagging questions, though. There are multiple alternative theories of gravity out there in the science world, and they're mostly tied up with our unanswered questions about those black holes, dark matter, and dark energy. Let me drop for a sec. To the questions in a little while. I'm almost finished with this particular story. There are dozens of alternative theories of gravity, and most of them haven't fared well against the evidence. But they still do exist, because if one of these experiments designed to test Einstein's theory of general relativity proves it to be false, we have to have other theories to back to work with at that point. There are a lot of challenges to work out if the Event Horizon Imager will ever come to pass. With the Event Horizon Telescope project, each observatory saves its data on a hard drive, which is then delivered to a data processing center. All the data from each SOAP is combined using an atomic clock for extreme precision. But how will that all work in space, you might ask? Well, with the Event Horizon Telescope project, hard drives with data are transported to the processing center by airplane. Now, that's, of course, not possible in space. According to the paper, a laser link would be used to send the data to Earth for processing. There's always a precedent. There's already a precedent for that. And they say the planned future space missions will refine laser communications even further. Another challenge is the precise position and speeds of the satellites needed to produce these sharp images. The concept demands that you must be able to ascertain the position and speed of the satellite very accurately. But they really believe that the project is feasible. The Event Horizon Imager would work in conjunction with the Event Horizon Telescope project as a kind of hybrid interferometer, combining the data from all of the terrestrial observations with the data from the orbital observatory. The best of both worlds, you'd say. Using a hybrid like this, we could provide the possibility of creating moving images of black holes, and you might be able to observe even more and also weaker sources. The more radio telescopes, the better, I always say. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
Ed Tuck Sheehan.
Wesley, what's your question?
So there are many tiny satellites can create image of giant space. You have a synchronization of those satellites that move along the boundary of a certain synthetic aperture and capture a few light patterns from observed space. But the question is, if you have one pixel from one satellite and the same pixel from another satellite, you only have a slight angle of difference between those two. That will give you maybe something like 3D. But how do you physically assemble that picture? And to achieve?
Well, I don't really know the mathematics. It is very, very complicated and requires the supercomputers to crunch them and a long time. I mean, the fact that we were just talking about the Event Horizon Telescope Project images only a few weeks ago, but the actual images themselves were taken over a 10-day period a year earlier, kind of gives you a sense of the incredibly excruciating mathematics required for that. You know, the nature of interferometers is the farther you can source the same signal, the more information and the higher the resolution that you can obtain from these devices. So if you had, theoretically, a series of radio telescopes that were all covering the entire solar system, then it would be an amazing resolution available to us. But we're kind of stuck with the Earth at this point because that's where we have our radio telescopes. But it's a novel and interesting theory of extending it out beyond the planet. And where you can put it into close orbit, you could put it into maybe farther orbit. And every farther orbit we put these things out to will improve the resolution.
And WS2N?
Well, I have more about it. Hold on. The picture of the Earth do have satellites. We have a satellite. However, they are too tiny to be resolved in the image. Most of images of our planets are only a few thousand pixels in diameter. So unless an object is of the order of a kilometer or more, or mile or more, with no object in the vicinity of the planet, it would only be the fraction of the pixel, and that is visible in the image. So when we talk about a black hole, or the body, and having ability to create better picture, better resolution, you got to see it from the distance as exactly the same as we were to take the picture from the Earth. So it simply doesn't explain. That's why it's not about mathematics. It's about the technology and to achieve.
Well, Wes, you know, mathematics is part of technology. Technology is part of mathematics. The size of an aperture determines its resolution because there's the fraction on the edges, and to a degree, interferometers suffer from the same problem as well. Yes, your sensors have to detect a signal to make any sense of it, but they don't require quite as much to perceive changes in micro arc seconds, which is what we're unfortunately dealing with. Although the event horizon of M87 was larger than our solar system, still it was millions of light years away. That's a very far distance, and the entire event basically took up something like 4.5 micro arc seconds, which is an infinitesimal amount, and yet we were able to actually crunch numbers and detect the images that I put up on the website. So they are there; they're not make-believe. I'm sure the mathematics would give all of us a headache. Things that require number crunching for a year on supercomputers are not simple math.
Thank you very much.
Welcome, Wes. Paul, you wanted to say something?
Yes, well, you know, I saw that documentary, and you know, they did explain that, you know, the Earth, of course, is round, so certain antennas were getting the photons earlier than the other part of the Earth. You know, Antarctica might be getting a photon, you know, way after Spain. They had to figure that all in. So that was all part of the number crunching. But it was, as you were talking, you said like 10 days. I don't know if it was 10 days or 10 weeks. They did say it was a long time before they realized they even had anything, because all the information had to go to supercomputers in Massachusetts, and the other one was in Germany. But, you know, to increase the aperture, you know, as you're talking about the laser capability in space, I'm dropping. You know, you could, you know, the next step would be to have, you know, a set of antennas actually on the other side of the sun. You could launch a satellite from Earth, which we've done many times, and have it lag behind the Earth. Kepler, for instance, is doing that. It just every year it keeps getting further and further away. The stereo satellites are orbiting the sun as well. They're going further and further away, and eventually they're going to come back and eventually come back to, you know, we'll be coming close to those same satellites that were launched many years ago. So you could do that. Launch these satellites and have one on the other side of the sun and then us on the other side of the sun. They could take their pictures, and then as time goes, you know, with the tremendous storage, you store terabytes of data now on these flash drives. You could have that satellite hold that information all the way until, you know, it gets near enough to Earth, and then they could start setting it with lasers, you know, because it's so much of it. And then combine it, and then do the same thing. Now, I think that would be the next step. Then you could get a 200 million mile aperture, you know, from one end to the other, right past the sun. Back to you, Roy. WS2N.
Yeah, that's an option too. I think they're kind of doing little baby steps. They're going to orbit them relatively close to Earth, so they don't have to worry about delay times and kind of losing a signal for half a year or however they design the experiment. So you know, they'll do. Hopefully, if it comes to fruition, they'll do a proof of concept for something that's orbiting at a significantly a larger diameter than Earth, and see what kind of images they're able to get, and who knows, they might be able to move farther. It becomes more problematic the wider you make it, because then you have the problem of sinking and lasers and waiting for things to travel in their orbits and what have you. But the Event Horizon Telescope Project did apparently take place over a 10-day period in May. They chose that time because they thought that generally there would be good weather conditions surrounding the radio telescopes in all the eight locations, although I think only seven locations were used for M87 because the South Pole radio telescope doesn't see M87, and it's a northern star. But yeah, it was a 10-day course. They're thinking of making a moving video, taking a picture, a series of pictures each day. If I remember correctly, they spent 12 hours imaging M87 and the other 12 hours imaging our own central black hole, Sagittarius A star, because they were in good location during different 12-hour cycles in the day. But it was only a 10-day experiment. It was all the number crunching and the shipping hard drives back and forth that took all this time.
Yeah, I think on the documentary, they said months. I think it was a couple of months before they got results. But I'm not sure. I forgot about that. But yeah, it was a 10-day deal. Very good, Roy. Back to you.
Yeah, I know that the South Pole got basically snowed in, which is probably a constant problem with them. They couldn't get their hard drives out for months. That might have been what they were alluding to.
You're right. That was part of it. That was part of the documentary. Anybody could bring up the Smithsonian channel. If it's still there, you bring up Black Hole Hunters, and it's a very good documentary. Back to you there. Back to you, Roy. WS1.
Okay, very good, Paul. There has been a slew of excellent reports, the YouTubes, great, you know, I'm sure NOVA is going to do a special on this thing. It's kind of been done all over the place. But I don't grow tired of it. It's a fascinating field, and it promises to give us a great deal of further insight. I'm still hoping that Albert comes through and general relativity is not disproven. I would rather throw away the concepts of dark energy and dark matter than throw away general relativity, but we'll see what the future holds. Okay, on with the next. The smartphone makers might soon not have much to brag about when it comes to the number of pixels that they can fit on a pocket-sized screen. Researchers at the University of Cambridge have come up with a way to create pixels that are a million times smaller than those used on even Apple's Retina display. But extreme pixel density is somehow the least interesting part of this particular breakthrough. The pixels are created by first coating microscopic gold particles, just a few billionths of a meter in size, with an electroactive polymer called polyaniline that can change its structure in the presence of an electrical field. That's accomplished in a vat where the polymer and the gold particles are mixed, and the results are then simply sprayed onto a plastic film that's been coated with a mirror finish. It sounds like a surprisingly simple process, and it turns out that one of the best features of this new technology is that it's relatively easy and cheap to manufacture. Instead of exciting a chemical material to emit photons, light actually ends up getting trapped between these microscopic gold particles and the reflective backing that adheres to. But despite the diminutive size of the pixels, they actually end up producing a glow that appears much larger and brighter to the human eye, even in direct sunlight. The color of each pixel can also be tuned across the entire spectrum by applying a specific electric current which alters each gold particle's polymer coating. Once changed, each particle can retain its color indefinitely, so a constant supply of power isn't needed. So in addition to being affordable to manufacture and flexible, this new technology is also rather cheap to operate. Let me drop for a sec. So in a way, it looks like it may work like a full-color, high-resolution relative of the so-called e-paper that many of us have experienced on the Kindle e-readers. But how practical are these gold dust displays as a replacement for other technologies like LCDs and organic light-emitting diodes? Well, the researchers at the University of Cambridge have suggested potential applications like screens in the size of large buildings, architecture that could change its appearance without the need of a paint job, or even garments that could actively camouflage the wearer in the same way that octopus and cuttlefish can hide in their environment. In other words, they're envisioning applications that might be inappropriate for fragile traditional displays. But is the refresh rate fast enough to show moving video, you ask? Well, can the individual pixels be controlled with enough accuracy to produce recognizable images? Well, the team is currently looking for partners to help further development of their creation. And the answers about just how far-reaching this application could be or may not be answered for a while. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
What is the difference between light trapped in crystal versus light trapped in gold plates environment?
Could you be a little bit more descriptive about the two environments where the light is, quote, trapped? It's kind of a nomer to say it's kind of trapped. It's basically kind of bouncing in and out and taking up time before it goes someplace else.
It's known that something that is called trapped light. So that the light bounces for, let's say, 1 minute, and then it goes out. But since you changed terminology, there is no question. You actually gave the answer. I told you.
Okay, Wes. Yeah, a lot of times people are kind of messy with the English and how they explain things, because a lot of times the short way of describing it is that, you know, light is stopped or even that light is, quote, slowed down, which is a problem because light tends to want to travel at the speed of light in the vacuum. It has an apparent velocity decrease in media, but that's more due to interesting phase interrelationships than the actual velocity of the electromagnetic wave. But, yeah. Okay, good. And talking about such things, wave-particle duality. That's one of the least intuitive aspects of quantum mechanics. The double-slit experiment that demonstrated the wave-like properties of undecidedly unwave-like things like electrons have been reproduced in university and labs and classrooms all over the world for the past century. But what about trying that experiment with antimatter? Well, recently, scientists created one of the most important experiments in the history of physics, perhaps. But this time, they used antimatter instead of regular matter. All matter particles have a corresponding antimatter particle, which shares most of the same properties, but is a mirror image of that particle and has the opposite charge. Decades ago, scientists determined that when regular matter particles pass through a pair of parallel slits, They create an interference pattern as if they were waves. The new experiment from researchers in Italy and Switzerland unsurprisingly affirms that antimatter behaves the same way. But conducting the research required overcoming some technical difficulties. The double-slit experiment serves as the foundation of our understanding of matter. Light, when passed through a pair of parallel slits onto a photosensitive detector, reveals a pattern of bright and dark spots. This proves that light travels as a wave. It splits upon hitting the slits, and the waves either cancel each other or magnify the strength of the signal, creating the pattern. Surprisingly, beams of matter particles, like electrons, will also form this diffraction pattern. Even if you send the electrons one at a time, this demonstrates the probabilistic dual wave-particle behavior of matter and light, and that is the foundation of quantum mechanics. Let me drop for a sec.
The nerd.
Well, I don't know. It's up to you if you don't like the information. Physicists have already performed diffraction experiments on antimatter that demonstrate its dual wave-particle nature. But this is the first demonstration of a double-slit analog in antimatter, according to a paper published in Science Advances. Antimatter is rarer than matter, but it exists here on Earth most commonly in the form of positrons or anti-electrons produced by certain kinds of radioactive decay. The Laboratory for Nanostructure Epitaxy and Spintronics in Silicon facility in Italy produces a focus beam of approximately 5,000 positrons per second. The scientists shine the beam through two gold-coated silicon nitride gratings, each with a different distance between the grates. The beams then hit a detector, a 50 micrometer thick gelatin full of silver bromide crystals, which serves as a three-dimensional photographic film. Upon analyzing the results, the researchers found that the antimatter beam had produced evidence of the expected interference pattern, according to the paper. They concluded that positrons had hit the grating, interacting with the other, with another as matter waves, and produced the expected interference pattern on the film. Let me drop for a sec. Dave, this is only the first step for the quantum interferometer with positron and lasers program, which is devoted to performing these interference patterns-based studies on antimatter. They next plan to perform studies on other antimatter particles like positronium, that's a positron bound to an electron in a very exotic atom, and an anti-hydrogen, an antiproton orbited by a positron. Eventually, they hope to use antimatter to make measurements of the Earth's gravitational field, and again, see if the other laws of physics hold up when tested on antimatter instead of the regular matter that we all know and love. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is Phil, AC2GS.
Enter exchange.
Wesley.
How about if we try backwards, gauge to wave particle duality? Back from the backside into the front. The significance of the wave particle duality is that particles end up distributed according to the probability laws and therefore exhibit the wave properties. So in other words, the probability of the particle being in any location is the wave. But the actual physical appearance of this particle is not. And as a matter of fact, positron is particle. It's a subatomic particle with the same mass as an electron and is numerically equal to positive charge. So it's not a wave. Enter exchange.
You're quite correct, Wesley. Electrons and protons and anti-electrons and anti-protons, they're all particles, they all have mass. The problem is that quantum mechanics, the underlying very basis of quantum mechanics is the wave-particle duality of both energy, which is obviously wave-like, and unfortunately particles, which is definitively not obviously wave-like. The way that we tend to try and describe it to make sense to ourselves is that the electron isn't inherently a wave, but the probability of where an electron exists can be described accurately as a wave function, an equation that describes waves, and that that's the probability. When you square the wave function of a particle, you get its distribution probability, where it could be. There are places where it's there most of the time. There are places where these particles have nodes in their wave equations where their probability of being there doesn't exist. You have that with an electron. Electrons have a wave function.